This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. It's only Tuesday. It feels like Friday, doesn't it? Okay, we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis. In fact, one of our guests on the Breakfast Grill this morning is Zuna, who's a well-known editorial cartoonist or political cartoonist, depending on how you want to use the term or describe him. But the important thing is, I think he's been one of the most high-profile victims of political harassment of the last couple of years. And because an extraordinary, extraordinarily committed to the fight against Barisan Nasional the last 20 years.
Yeah, so we've got BFM's Morning Run certainly milking the new Malaysia for all it's worth. We've got Zuna.
Do you disagree? Do you think we shouldn't?
No, I totally think we should. No, this is great. And it's one thing to convey his thoughts via cartoon form, which is obviously where he's most potent. It'd be interesting to hear him convey his thoughts via the radio format.
Yeah, and also we've had him on video. I interviewed him when we used to have that Uncensored series, I don't know if you remember, many years ago. An extract from that video interview I did with him made it to a documentary on Zuna. So I'm famous.
Nice.
Thank you very much.
Pseudo famous. Riding on Zuna's coattails there, aren't
I? What can I say? By any means necessary, I think.
Look at your Twitter, the amount of followers that you have, Sharad.
Oh. Yeah.
Way past
well, it's
all
paltry.
Of
it's paltry when you consider how famous I ought to be.
Well, Zuna was also on the travel ban list, guys. Remember that?
Yes.
And
he's
taken the former government to court. Yes. And I heard that. I think he's going ahead with that.
I believe the ban was, in fact, lifted.
Yeah, it's been lifted.
Earlier this year. Now, so remember, you can always be part of that conversation. Stay with us until 8 o'clock in the morning. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, and we'll put your question or comment to Zuna. Now, just a note, what's interesting is that there is life after political power. Barack Obama and his wife Michelle intend to make TV and films for Netflix.
Huh.
Yeah. So I could just see it. Could you imagine retiring politicians, Malaysian politicians, doing the same? I could just see the Najib and Rosma channel and many more.
Right. And it's there'll be a special episode on Birkin bags or Hermes bags. And, I wonder which actor or actress will play Najib or Rosma. Because there's this Twitter petition, or this petition on Twitter, as to who will play Joe Lowe. So apparently it's...
It could be you.
Well,
do you have
not
aspirations?
Quite there yet. Well, no, I got to put on a few more pounds. But Dr.
Anything for art.
I know, right?
Anything for art.
If the paycheck is
it
worth it.
It could pay really well,
yeah,
actually.
Why not,
yeah.
Right? But Dr.
Jason, Robert De Niro put on a lot of weight on for Raging Bull.
Oh, okay. Well, I will have to sleep on it before I make this career change. But aside from me, Dr. Jason Leong has put himself forward as perhaps playing Joe Lowe. Go figure that.
Quite similar. Are there similarities there?
Yeah, well, they're
large Chinese blokes.
Yeah, I think Renee Zellweger also, she put on weight for that show Bridget Jones' Diaries.
Okay, I think you both misunderstood me. Barack and Michelle Obama are going to make TV and films. Oh. They're not going to be in TV and films.
Okay.
They're not going to be starring in a show about themselves.
Oh, that's a lot less fun.
They're going to actually become. And I wonder about that. You know, what is it they have flops? Can you imagine you end your career as President of the United States on a high, and then you go on to make movies that lose money at the box office or everybody gives a thumbs down to?
Right. You know, because very often after leaving the White House, you've got the former First Lady and the former President of the United States who often just hit the speaking circuit and they can get a ton of money from that. So why is Barack and Michelle Obama wanting to jump into this new endeavor and take on all those risks versus just sticking to the good old bread and butter, speaking to really rich clientele?
Because they're very young, for starters. I think that's one thing.
And ambitious.
Okay. And we'll be back with a look at the cutest general elections ever held. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Shohad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Now, you know, we're coming into GE40. There was a lot of talk that it would be the dirtiest elections that we've ever had. And some pieces written in foreign newspapers echoed that sentiment. But in an interesting turnaround, a primary school in Negeri Sembilan held mock elections. I believe they were mock elections for their young wards, and even had ink on their fingers. So now this is one of those extraordinarily cutesy type of stories that might make some people a bit nauseous, but others just, you know, tingle with joy.
I think it's really great. I mean, it creates awareness, it educates them. This happened in a Sekolah Kebangsaan Felda Paso 2, Dua in Jempol. And basically, yeah, you can see the kids with their fingers all inked up, and they have, this happened during a teacher's day on May 16, and you get to vote for the school's most handsome teacher, most active teacher, best teacher, and, you know, other titles. And
sounds like a self-serving election
to
legitimize the ruling class.
Guys, the turnout rate 100%.
What are you holding your head in your hand for?
Well,
Tan Chung Han,
I mean, I'm observing the body language of both of you, and obviously you've got Joyce here who's waving her arms around, so she's the one tingling with excitement here. Whereas I'm going to assume that, Sharad, this is making you nauseous.
Only slightly.
Why is it? I think it's great that kids at that young, tender age at least exposed to the process. I mean, never mind the issues, because, you know, those can be rather polarizing.
Yeah, handsomest teacher in school.
Well,
can you imagine?
I can see the losing teacher crying,
bawling their eyes out, saying, "How can this be? Right. His nose is not aligned to his chin."
All right.
So on and so forth.
Sharad, why don't you lie down on the couch and we'll commence our session, and I'll bill you afterwards. Then it appears that Sharad has got some deep-seated issues from his schooling days.
Well, yeah. They also plan to have an election for the head prefect and deputy head prefect for 2019 at the end of this year.
I must say. I think it, in fact, is extraordinarily important for young people to be empowered, to feel that they can participate and understand these processes, because it really, you know, in our country, I think we have elections or these kind of public, processes that far too rarely, you know, we should have them more often. We should have a return of local council elections. We should devolve power and so on and so forth. So there's a serious side to this. But when I look at the picture of those young ones with their fingers inked, you know, looking like all little devils, little cherubs. I don't know which one it is, because I'm sure if you ever had to deal with people under 4 foot so-and-so, you'd know the difficulties of discipline and so on and so forth.
Sure. And now, beyond the process, though, beyond the electoral process, right, I wonder at what age can we start exposing these kids to the issues that are at hand, though? You know, is there an age-friendly manner by which to get them politically engaged? You know, because, you know, very often you hear from parents, you know, they try to shield their kids from, say, religious influences or political influences, because they can be quite polarizing and difficult to discuss, right? Especially in a classroom setting where, you know, it is widely seen to be more neutral than other settings. So, you know, can we start having that conversation now? You know, at what age, you know, should kids be exposed to some of these political influences?
I think when they start asking questions, I guess they're ready. In the recent G14, my eldest asked me, you know, what
who is how old?
About six, turning six. And he asked, "Mommy, why y'all, what is election day? Why is there no school? And why do you have no work?" And we had to make preparations of who to babysit them while my husband and I go out to vote, because my husband and I are not voting in the same area. So, you know, we took turns and all that. So he was wondering. And his aunt came down from Singapore just to vote. And he thought, oh, this must be, like, why is Aku down? You know, there's
it's
no
so
reason.
Significant,
yeah,
isn't
yeah.
It?
To him, I think he asked, and then when we came back with our fingers inked, and he realized all the adults in the room had this, and he asked us, like, why is it black? Why can't it come out? You know, all these questions. And we thought, oh, we're trying to explain to him what is like. I'm not sure if he got it, but I think it's great. It's great once they start asking questions. I think it's good to explain to them why. And I told him, oh, this is where you vote. He didn't really understand that. I said it's like two teams. You vote for one team or a particular person that you want to vote for.
Sometimes there are three teams,
and they will and
or
they
five will be, teams. Sometimes there are two teams, and one team is pretending to be a team, or it's really a team. Gagasan Sajatra.
And the flags, the amount of flags that they see out. Yeah, you know.
See, because you know, from my primary school days, that's all I remember.
The flags.
Yeah, the flags, and you know, like some of them would fall off, and we just, you know, take it and play and wrap it around our necks and pretend like we're Superman.
Okay, no, I think that the difference is what's at stake, right? So in this case, the kids were asked to vote on four people they're familiar with, right? It was the teachers, and it was Teachers' Day. So you know, I think you know the thing about children is that. I think you can introduce them to reason and logic and, you know, and the frameworks and all that quite early on. I, you know, it really depends. I grew up with parents who always tried to reason with me. And I think, you know, and that's important. That can happen as early as, well, early as, you know, well, as early as a kid can start to communicate.
Right.
And they can communicate very early, right? So it's a question of what it is at stake. I mean, why talk to your four-year-old about 1MDB, for instance? You wouldn't, right? You would talk to them about something that they're familiar with.
Or even, you know, just exposing them to the concept of democracy, you know? And I agree with you, Sharad. At the end of the day, giving them this sense of empowerment that they, you know, are able to, you know, make these decisions, either be their most handsome teacher or the most handsome prime minister.
Yeah, and I related back to school. I said the two teams is like to take care of the country, like your headmistress of the school, that kind of thing, yeah. Hmm.
Okay. Well, what we can do next is to talk about handbags because they're so important to the life of the nation. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was the 70s band, The Specials with A Rat Race. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. And we're going to be talking about Birkin bags because so many of us aspire to that. Who wouldn't want a Birkin handbag in this room?
I'm good.
You're good. Okay. You're good. But in fact, you know, being a fashionista, and leading the... I'm not talking about you being a fashionista, because you're clearly not. I'm talking about people who are fashionistas, who set trends for others. Very interesting, because accessories... and if you remember that visit by the Singaporean Prime Minister and his wife to Washington, D.C., she went with this $12 Sing Dollar handbag that was made by a kid with special... needs or with disabilities. And that created a conversation in Singapore about fashion and the price of things. Now, on the other end of the extreme, because it had the former... well, she's not the former wife of the prime minister. She's the wife of the former prime minister, Najib Razak, who also had made fashion statements. And she, along with other spouses of leaders, do these things, including Melania Trump. Now, to the question is, what kind of social impact these individuals have on society? We turn to Azura Rahman. She was a former host of BFM's Style File. We asked her for her thoughts on the impact that first ladies have on fashion.
Now, it's interesting that you tried to compare the two first ladies. Now, Melania Trump herself, I think for the people who actually rushed out to get a Birkin crocodile bag after seeing her bring it into the White House, are severely misinformed in terms of fashion choices. I don't think she really is a fashion icon in terms of a first lady as how Michelle Obama was, or even Nicolas Sarkozy's wife, Carla Bruni, was, or even Samantha Cameron. And at the same time, with our former... Prime Minister's wife, Rosmah Mansour, to see whether it's increased its value or not. The kind of anecdotal things that I've been hearing from people is that, you know, those who actually own the bags, they feel a bit embarrassed to carry it now because, you know, there's so much scrutiny on the bag now and how much it costs. So people are putting things together and saying, oh, so you earn that amount of money? You can actually afford this bag? How is it that can afford such a bag? And in many ways, I think riding on the new political feeling that, you know, Malaysians have now and how they're becoming much more aware of how the elite of yesterday is no longer in favor, I would think that the progressive fashionista, anyway, wouldn't be caught dead wearing a Birkin right at this moment without wanting to cause too much of a conversation in a negative way.
So to get an understanding of the magnitude of such luxury items belonging to elected officials and their family, we asked Azura if she thinks spouses of elected officials should be allowed or expected to don these luxurious items.
I mean, of course, you know, when it comes to private citizens who want to carry whatever bag they want, you know, even if it's Kim Kardashian, whatever it is, it's fair for such people to dabble into whatever kind of fashion that they'd like because they are private citizens. Whereas why is the politicians who are elected officials who basically are supposed to be drawing a salary that's paid for by the citizens of that country, they have to answer to the people of that country, you know? And maybe in the case of Melania Trump, obviously, you know, Donald Trump himself comes from a billionaire status before he became president of the United States of America. So you can say that, yeah, you know, she owned the bag before she came to power. Whereas someone like, you know, Datin Rosmah Mansur, who's the wife of a career politician who's been drawing a salary from the rakyat, when you carry a bag like that, you know, it does raise questions, especially knowing how much it costs. And of course, there's always the defense of it might have been a gift. Well, I think, you know, in the new dawn of Malaysia, we're not going to be able to put up with such reasons anymore. Gifts should be declared. You know, gifts need to be something that possibly be returned in case it's actually being viewed as a form of corruption. So I do think when it's a bag like an Hermes Birkin, of course, people are going to be asking questions, and they are right to ask questions when spouses of, you know, the premiers of countries are carrying such bags. But if it's a case of where, you know, that certain first lady or even that certain premier of that country decides to champion local labels and wear clothes by local designers, now that's a different story altogether.
That was Azura Rahman, BFM's host. Oh, she's the former host of BFM's Style File, and that was the show that she did. Yeah, so what do you think? You know, should Rosma have been, should she now be criticized for her choices, you know, in terms of accessories?
I mean, a lot of people have come out against this and saying that how can she afford this? A lot of questions have come out. Remember, Datin Sri Rosmah has said that she could, there was time when she said that she had saved money to afford the kind of things that she buy as well as, but if you look at recent news flow that's come out in online, there's also photos of Dr. Siti Hasma carrying a bag which is a Marie Claire handbag that is 125 ringgit 10 cent. This is trending online right now, and that has gotten a lot of people talking about it, and you know, obviously right. Saying like, wow, look at that, you know. So remember the whole Bata thing as well, that Tun Dr. M that has gone viral as well. So
yeah, and Anwar Ibrahim was barefoot in his interview with Channel News Asia.
Right, because as at home, I think at the end of the day, right, it's these politicians or people in the public sphere, right, they have to deal with reputational risks. The messaging is not just via prepared statements, but it's also via, non-verbal signals, to put it.
Okay, taking us up to the first bulletin of the morning, Natalie Imbruglia with A Wrong Impression. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Pat Benatar with Hit Me With Your Best Shot. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. And the morning run continues. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis. It is the 22nd of May and it's coming up to 6:40 in the morning. Now, yesterday, 20 people from a coalition of women's organizations that included this coalition, the group of 20 included men, demonstrated peacefully in front of Istana Negara demanding that the new Pakatan Harapan government make good on their pledge of 30% women's representation in cabinet. Now, we've already got a first with the first woman deputy prime minister the country's ever had. But the current lineup, because it's not the full lineup of the cabinet, is short of the 30%. So at this point in time, it's still about 20%, right? The question is, and there is a tremendous sensitivity to the issue of women's representation now, how they are perceived in the media and so on and so forth. The question that has come up very interestingly, Joyce, and I don't know what you think about this, is husbands and wives. Anwar Ibrahim, unelected, sort of leading the way in some instances, comporting himself as if he was the elected leader, so the critics say, leaving Wan Azizah behind.
Is this because of the photo op or something that came up in, over the weekend showing him walking ahead of her because of that? So optics. Well, Dato' Sri Anwar is a personality himself. Again, husbands and wives. I don't. Is that? Do you think he's overshadowing her in a way? I don't think so, and I don't think she minds him. You know, it's at the end of the day, they're a team and they make a good team. Husband and wives are also a team. You know, right. Yeah. Oh, must
so
remember
politically
that.
Correct.
No, but I
but
always
okay,
believe.
They're critics, right? So the critics are, in fact, and I think they're often women, but you know, not necessarily only women, who are concerned that in some ways, Dato' Sri Wan Aziza is not being given her due because of this confusion in terms of the optics. His personality, as you say, Joyce, is quite large.
Yeah, he is quite a personality. Big shoes.
Right. So the critics are coming from, well, I guess, a black and white or a more black and white world, or at least a black and white approach, right? They are going by the rule book. So if Wan Aziza has the title of DPM right now, so she should be leading as opposed to Dato' Sri Anwar, who is not yet an elected MP. So that's where they're coming from. But if you zoom out, and the broader context is that very often Wan Aziza is seen as the reluctant politician, right? And in fact, it's the idea of holding that position or holding that seat until Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim, now that he's gotten his pardon, can then make that transition into active politics and then become an elected representative whenever that by-election does happen.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that she's not leading. I mean, to these critics, you know, she could be doing, I mean, she could be effective in her job and doing all the things that she's doing as deputy PM, but that doesn't mean that maybe it's not her personality. You know, maybe that's just not her, but yeah.
Yeah, but I think the issues of protocol, I think that people will point to or critics will point to. And I think maybe a slight disappointment that some women's advocates might feel in Dato' Wan Aziza, you know, sort of demurring and being the reluctant politician and, you know, and signaling very clearly that in many ways she's had to play this role because of the political crisis of 20 years ago that thrust her into this position. So, so she's not, as it were, the perfect woman politician, at this point in time. But she's been an extraordinary role model, I think you'd have to admit.
Yes.
And it's not just in that traditional sense of being loyal to your husband, but in terms of...
For the country.
For the country, right? So what are the critics... So what's going on in the minds of those critics? That's what I'm wondering.
Maybe just optics. I'm not sure, but I think this came about. This is my speculation on what happened over the weekend. But that doesn't mean that Wan Aziza is not playing her role. It could just be at that moment, right? You know. But we do not know what's happening behind the scenes. The amount of talks that she's having behind the scenes, how she got Anwar released. I think Anwar did credit her and Tun Dr. Siti Hasma for playing a large role in getting Tun M and him together.
Right,
for that,
You know, and the engagements that she's had with the palace, you know, during that interim when we didn't really have a prime minister for like a day, 24 hours or so, right, or less than that. But I think, you know, just trying to get into the minds of the critics, again, I'm just trying to understand here. I think it's the idea that, look, we have this opportunity for a hard reset at the federal government level. And if we have these ideals in place, you know, be it 30% women representation at the cabinet level or even minority representation, we want to try and strive to be as close to those ideals as possible, because this is as good an opportunity as any. You know, this is once in 60 years.
You know, and also you look at the cabinet so far in terms of optics. There has been an extraordinary change, but there are still gaps, and you know, a lack of East Malaysian representation at this point in time, also a huge a gap for this particular cabinet at this point, because really it's an ongoing process. We haven't reached the
and
end.
And female participation
We're talking about female, but so also
East Malaysia.
Okay, we'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was the Supremes with Stoned Love. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. One of the key issues in this elections was the question of the government's finances and the state in which they are. Now, according to Prime Minister Tun Dr. Mahathir, Malaysia is saddled with over 1 trillion ringgit in debt. And we sorry, we and that, of course, is something that we'll come back to later on. Now we want to take a look at the kind of argument, the conversation that are happening on the side of the losers. And Najib Razak has been blamed for the loss of UMNO, Barisan Nasional, and so on and so forth. And Noor Jazlan, former MP from the state of Johor, has come out to defend him. The question is the blame game, which Noor Jazlan says we shouldn't engage in, is that the right strategy for UMNO moving forward?
Well, I don't know if that really constitutes a strategy per se, but I think right at the onset, and I'm going to use this phrase quite often here, this hard reset, right? I think it's imperative that the former ruling coalition then identifies the root cause of the problem, you know, be it Najib or otherwise. Well, in this case, at least according to Noor Jazlan's perspective, you know, he says that the former Prime Minister, Dato Sri Najib, must answer for BN's loss in GE14.
Mm. Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the timing of it. Suddenly, now everyone's saying, oh, you should have, could have, would have. But you guys were on the same boat. You guys were there. I mean, why suddenly now only like, oh, you know, we don't tell me he made, there was a comment in quotes, don't tell me he does not read social media like Facebook and Twitter about issues touching on him and his family. Impossible. Yeah, okay. And I mean, if you are there and you see, why don't you tell him? I mean, for me, I guess it's like that, I think a listener said it's like the story of the emperor and his new clothes.
Yeah, yeah. I do think that, you know, winners have their narrative. They tell a particular story of what happened in GE14, but so do the losers, right? Yeah. And you have to, I think maybe the dust hasn't quite settled on the losers' camp as to what happened. We've had the former Prime Minister come out to say that it was lies and deception that promoted publicly that led to the downfall. Not his fault, right? Other people's slander against him. Now you have others who say that it was his lack of leadership or his unwillingness to listen to what was going on that also was in fact the cause. And I think on that side of the aisle, we still haven't got a single narrative that they have a consensus on.
Right. And obviously, you know, given that this is a developing story, that narrative, I think, is bound to some might say change, some might say evolve, right, over time. And so, because look, it's one thing for you to criticize within the party because you stand to lose a lot. I mean, just ask Muhyiddin and Shafi Abdal, although that gamble paid off for those two individuals, right? It's something else for someone to criticize from the outside where you've got nothing to lose. So on top of that, lateral perspectives aside, there's also this timeline factor that you have to take into account, right? Because if, let's say, BN did win GE14, like many of the analysts and researchers and pollsters that we spoke to expected, right, then this wouldn't even be a conversation, right? So there's a timeline element, and also that's the parallel perspective, right? On which side are you criticizing from?
And what about the question of factionalism or the fight that's happening or brewing, that we're told brewing in UMNO at this point in time? It's now happening over the question of whether the top posts should or should not be contested. But that clearly is a bid for what is seen as a kind of power vacuum. Najib, you know, held the party together. He was the center of the party. I'm not quite sure if his supporters want him to step aside. He has stepped aside. The question is, you know, whether he wants to come back. But yeah, I think the party itself is now trying to figure out. It did get votes. It would probably be looking at the numbers and said that one of the reasons we lost is that our members did not come out and vote for us. So come next general election, they will come back and vote for us if we get things right.
And if they get the right leader to lead them. Yeah, I mean, they have to also relook and reset themselves in a way and relook at what went wrong. As Sharat, you said, maybe post GE14, they have all of them, winners and losers, will have to analyze what happened and from there try and, I guess, from the losing end, they have to try and right the wrong.
So blaming it actually is one and perhaps a very good strategy, because if brand Najib was toxic, surely you want to dissociate the party from it, right? Or you as an individual within the party would want to dissociate yourself from Najib. So maybe the blame game is, in fact, the logical conclusion coming out of this this reversal.
Yeah, logical conclusion, or at least necessary for the time being, you know, because already we are seeing what appears to be some jostling for the top spot within UMNO. Now, that's within UMNO. Well, with MCA, and we've been playing this on the news, there was a press conference over the weekend, I believe, and BFM's Keith Kam was there. You know, you are seeing them perhaps, you know, they did the whole ceremony bowing and admitting to mistakes, and you know, what it can be perceived as moving forward a lot faster than perhaps their other counterparts within the Barisan National Coalition, right? So blame game, sure, it might be necessary at least for the near term, but then hopefully they can move forward and present a formidable federal opposition.
They should also look to being relevant. You know, because I think a number of them are not relevant anymore. And also look towards injecting fresh young blood.
Okay. We're coming up to the second bulletin of the morning, and taking us there is Paula Cole with Where Have All the Cowboys Gone? Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Shuai Kutin with me, Tan Cheng Han and Joyce Goh. And the morning run is continuing. It is just a little past 7 in the morning. 7 minutes past 7 in the morning. And it's the 22nd of May. Remember, we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis. We're going to have Zuna on Breakfast Grill this morning. So that's after the 8 o'clock news. So if you have any questions for him, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Remember Zuna, because well-known editorial cartoonist. In fact, I don't think he needs much of an introduction, not in Malaysia.
Well, certainly very important when it comes to the two-dimensional format, but I'm sure Shiraj will have a three-dimensional conversation with him. It'll be interesting to see how he performs.
Well, thanks for that vote of confidence. Okay, according to Prime Minister turned Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, Malaysia is saddled with over 1 trillion ringgit in debt. And I'm going to quote him here. He says, "We have never had to deal with this before. Before, we never faced debts higher than 300 billion ringgit. It's now climbed to 1 trillion. Now, to get a better understanding of what the Prime Minister is referring to and the magnitude of the problem, we spoke to economist Ali Salman, who is the CEO of the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs. First off, we asked him to help us explain how the Prime Minister arrived at this figure of 1 trillion ringgit.
We normally have to follow the numbers quoted by the central bank on macroeconomic data, including debt services. So honestly, I cannot comment on the number provided by the Prime Minister, Tun Mahathir, but based on the official data, the total debt to GDP is about 55%, which makes it roughly 645 billion ringgit of total debt. So it is significantly short of what Prime Minister has stated, but I'm not privy to latest update, just referring to the published data.
So if our total debt based on official data is 645 billion ringgit, we then ask Ali, where's the other almost 400 billion ringgit?
I think this, you know, we can only comment once we see the details and the background of it. We understand that there have been institutional loopholes in the country, and we understand that there are significant challenges which the government faces right now in terms of fixing these institutions. So we should wait still to get more details on these gaps. But one key aspect of where the government might be looking to fix is actually GLCs. You know, there are hundreds and thousands of GLCs which the government has been supporting. And that is an avenue of expenditure which the government needs to fix very soon.
So we asked Ali what he understands is the magnitude or the impact of such a level of debt, the 1 trillion ringgit debt, if it turns out to be true.
Well, first of all, the debt has to be seen not as a total stock, but debt has to be seen in the context of the annual debt repayment. This is a misunderstanding to quote the total debt figure as if the Malaysian government has to pay the entire debt in one go. The government allocate a particular portion of the budget in repayment. Right now, in the current budget, this repayment is 11% of the total budget, which is about 30 billion ringgit. According to the international standards, as long as the spending the debt repayment remains less than 30% of annual budget allocation, the debt scenario is very sustainable. And also at 55% of GDP, I do not think that Malaysian debt scenario is alarming. It's manageable, it's controllable, and the government needs to introduce certainly measures to improve the governance and to reduce the role of the government in the economy to improve the situation.
That was economist Ali Salman, CEO of IDEAS, on the statement made by the current Prime Minister that Malaysia's debt levels have reached 1 trillion ringgit.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. Today we have a PC with the new finance minister, YB Lim Guan Eng, and I'm sure this topic will come up. 1 trillion ringgit in debt is huge. And I mean, we need to see, as Ali said, right, what Ali has is based on official data. And you can see that the roughly total debt is what, 645 billion. That's officially. So where did this 1 trillion ringgit come from? I hope we can address that and see where are the leakages, or what is it about the official data? How come there's so much variance between the two?
Right, you know, and that's a huge discrepancy, right? Because you look at Malaysia's GDP as of the first quarter of this year, it was about 1.3 trillion ringgit in current prices, I believe. So if it's more, if the debt levels are more than 1 trillion ringgit, that's, you know, pushing it closer towards, you know, say 80% of GDP. This is public debt levels versus, you know, what we're seeing in terms of the official numbers as quoted by Ali about the low 50s. As a percentage of GDP.
I think the thing that interested me in, you know, is the issue of the loopholes. What is it that we're not seeing in the published, you know, data? And also that sort of echoes an earlier statement made by this government that perhaps official figures were massaged. And I think, so we carry on with that theme, that to what extent were figures, official figures, massaged by the administration of Najib Razak to perhaps, you know, instill confidence in his administration and so on and so forth. So we're waiting. It's still early days yet in terms of that.
Right. But I think Ali also made a good point in by the way we view debt should have its proper context. So not just as a percentage of GDP, but also in terms of repayment abilities. Because if you look at, say, just absolute debt as a percentage of GDP, Japan's one is like 240% of its GDP. Canada is close to 100%. Singapore is above 100%. All these other developed economies, the UK, US, you know, about 100% or so, right? So it's not so much, you know, what that figure is. Sure, 1 trillion ringgit, that is a psychologically important mark, especially for the layman, and that's why that number was bandied about in the lead up to GE14. But it's about the ability to pay back that debt.
Well, okay, ability is one thing, but also the question is, why have we gotten ourselves into the situation, right? Was the debt, you know, worth it, to put it very simply? I mean, was it because we spent it on things that were necessary, infrastructure and so on and so forth, or was it about enriching people? Was it because of mismanagement? Was it because of all the things we now suspect of the Najib Razak administration of?
And also whether or not the data that we have, how factual is it? How sure. real is it? We need to know what are the real facts out there.
Okay, we'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.